the information technology and the troubled humanities. That's the subject of this talk this evening. So I'm going to begin to try to explore this subject by recalling a climactic passage from Henry Adams' famous autobiography. He saw his education complete and was sorry he ever began it. As a matter of taste, he greatly preferred the 18th century education, when God was a father and nature a mother, and all was for the best in a scientific universe. He repudiated all share in the world as it was to be, and yet he could not detect where his responsibility began or ended. An education ought to make one ready for life, but Adam's education has turned out a kind of black comedy. His humanistic training has left him unprepared for the dynamo of the 20th century. So he joins the coming race as an observer, a scholar, what he calls an historian. But, quoting him again, all that the historian won was a vehement wish to escape. Now today, we pass through a similar historical moment, even more wrenching for a humanist than Adam's moment. The education, therefore, seems especially pertinent. And we don't want to guide our passage through this moment with tabloid reports like the Gutenberg elegies, which supply us with a cartoon set of alternatives. Information technology comprises an axis of evil that Sven Burkitt advises us to refuse. But we can no more refuse this digital environment than we can refuse the empire my country and yours, for better and for worse, has become. We may well feel a violent wish to escape both of these unfolding and closely enfolded, I would say, histories, but we do better to recall that as we are characters in these events, we bear a great responsibility toward them. And there precisely we find Henry Adams waiting for us, caught between two worlds. Not between a dead world and a world powerless to be born, but between two living worlds, one relatively young, the other ancient. He neither abandons the one nor refuses the other. The positive revelation of his great book tells us that we all always inhabit this kind of condition. And at certain historical moments, that universal experience seems especially clear, and certain figures come forward to render an honest accounting. His book also tells a cautionary tale, which is the second gift it passes on to us. If the dynamo and the virgin each have their humanities, in Adam's view, he represents himself as a kind of nowhere man. Not that he takes no action, but that he restricts his action to honest reporting. As a consequence, both virgin and dynamo emerge from his book as mysterious forces, in fact, as those images which so preoccupy and immobilize him throughout his book. Where will information technology leave humanity's education 5, 10, 20 N years from now? That question implicitly asks for something more than an honest report. Reading Adams helps me remember to be wary of making forecasts, but he also reminds me that I do have hopes, as well as a few convictions, about how we should look at these futures that we imagine lying before us. So let me begin with a conviction that we have to carry out what scholars used to call the praxis of theory, or as the poet better said, we must learn by going where we have to go. Involved here are two hard sayings that can no longer be fudged or tabled. First, integrating digital technology into our scholarship will have to be pursued on as broad a scale as possible. Circumstances are such that this work can no longer be safely postponed. Second, we have to restore textual and bibliographical work to the center of what we do. What are you saying? Learn Unix, hypermedia design, one or more programming languages, textual markup and its discontents. Learn bibliography and the sociology of texts, ancient and modern textual theory, history of the book. Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. And you ask why. At this point, I give only one reason, though by itself, if we draw its implications out, the reason will more than suffice. because information technology is now transforming the fundamental character of the library. The library, the chief focus of our cultural memory, as well as our central symbol for that memory's life and importance. That transformation is already altering the geography of scholarship, criticism, and educational method throughout the humanities. And it forecasts even more dramatic changes ahead, as I shall indicate in a moment more fully. Moreover, the shifting plates are already registering on the seismographs. Let's begin at that point, with the signals coming from current, well-known events. First of all, some happy signs of the times. Already, the library's reference rooms are well along to virtually complete virtualization, and it's difficult to believe any scholar regrets this. The transformation reflects the relative ease with which expository and informational materials translate into digital forms. To have immediately available to you those resources wherever you might choose to set up your computer and go online is a clear gain, and for older persons, an amazement, really a kind of miracle. Such things can turn the soberest scholar into a kind of digital groupie. Young persons tend to take these kinds of marvels for granted. I mean, you sit at your home computer and you turn on and you enter into all of the great libraries of the world and access their materials. Astonishing. And it's also the case that some remarkable scholars have been acute to see the educational opportunities that information technology makes possible for the humanities. The list of distinguished scholars is extensive. But of course, it's also the case that, compared with the distinguished and extensive body of paper-based scholarship, the list of IT projects is minuscule. Now for some tales from the dark side. Late in the 19th century, Matthew Arnold looked to France as a model for what he called the salutary influence of academies on culture in general. 25 years ago, Arnold's academic inheritors appeared to be living the realization of his hope. But then came the crash. Humanities scholarship and education has been a holy mess for some time. Looking at the way we live now in the academy, one can hardly not recall Trollope's great dark portrayal of the way we live now. What's going on? Where are the snows of yesteryear? Something like those very questions drove the editor of Critical Inquiry, Tom Mitchell, to summon the journal's board of editors to a symposium in April of 2003 to discuss the future of the journal and of the interdisciplinary fields of criticism and theory. Some of the most distinguished North American academics gathered in Chicago to assess the bad eminence that higher education in the humanities has gained, and specifically to ponder the future of criticism, and in particular of critical theory. I missed the Friday night public forum and pep rally for the symposium, but made it for the key event, the day-long Saturday discussions. From these, I went home shocked and more than a little dismayed at what I learned. Most of us registered one way or another the malaise that has grown widespread in the humanities in America. And I wasn't particularly disheartened that we were all uncertain about how best to deal with the problems we talked about. Something else was troubling, however. The degree of ignorance about information technology and its critical relevance to humanities education and scholarship. I've spent almost 25 years studying this subject, and the only way you have a chance of doing something about it, usefully, that is by hands-on, collaborative, interdisciplinary work. By designing and building the materials and applications and the tools that alone can teach how best to make and use these things. You don't learn a language by talking about it or reading books. You learn it by speaking it and by writing it. There's no other way. Anything less is just, well, theoretical. So far as information technology concerns traditional humanities, the issues are more clearly understood in the United Kingdom and in Europe than they are in the United States. Moreover, if you want to engage serious, practical conversations about humanities education and digital culture, America's most famous humanities research institutions, with few exceptions, in fact, I would say with no exceptions, are not the places to go. Go to community colleges, go to small colleges, do not go to Harvard, do not go to Princeton, do not go to Stanford. They don't know what's going on. The Critical Inquiry meeting explained why. We're illiterate. Besides myself, no one on the Critical Inquiry Board can use any of the languages we need to understand how to operate with proliferating digital technologies, not even elementary markup languages. Most had never heard of TEI, and no one I talked with was aware of the impact it was already exerting on humanities scholarship and education. The library, especially the research library, is a cornerstone, if not the very foundation, of modern humanities. It is undergoing, right now, a complete digital transformation. In the coming decades, and the process has already well begun, the entirety of our cultural inheritance will be transformed and re-edited in digital forms. Do we understand what that means, what problems it brings, how they might be addressed? Theoretical as well as very practical discussions about these matters have been going on for years, and decisions about them are taken every day. Yet digital illiteracy puts many of us on the margin of conversations and actions that affect the center of our cultural interests as citizens and our professional interests as scholars and educators. This situation has to change. And later, I will briefly describe a project called NINES that would, if successful, help to bring the change along. The project is practical in four ways. It addresses some of the most basic needs and self-interests of the working humanities scholar. It focuses on a limited, controllable region of the humanities, that's 19th century literary and cultural studies in Britain and America. It involves a collaboration between three key institutional entities: the research library, the individual scholar, and the professional organizations that help us to integrate and organize our work. And also, and let me just say as an aside here, the problems here are not technical. The problems are institutional. The technical problems are basically, if not solved, people can muddle their way through for a time until they will be more adequately solved. But basically, the technical problems are in place and can be dealt with. The institutional problems are gigantic. What seems to me impractical is to continue framing the crisis in humanities scholarship and education in the theological terms of critical theory and cultural studies. The public glances at goings-on like the Critical Inquiry Symposium with ironic amusement. To the reporters from New York and Boston who covered our symposium, it recalled nothing so much as Chaucer's Parliament of Fools, as we know from the stories they filed. And every year, as we also know, the MLA's annual meeting provides the media with great comic relief. But our tight little island's problems are by no means trivial, nor are they removed from the larger social scene. We have obligations as we are educators, obligations that society expects us to meet because of our special humanist vocation. Remember that Marxian distinction about the base and the superstructure? Remember it. Our ideological conflicts today are deeply embedded, commercially, economically, institutionally. Because this is the case, we have useful, practical things we can and we should be doing. But before those things become possible, we shall have first to stop the cant pervading so much of our discourse. An especially dismal aspect of our professional writing today is its ineffectual angelism, which is widespread. This problem is not simply a matter of prose styles or their failure. Our publications ride high on jargons of moral, social, and political engagement. In truth, these styles largely measure the extremity of our intramural focus and social disengagement. To be transgressive in a Routledge book or a Critical Inquiry essay, and that word transgressive has grown legions, is simply dispiriting. Jargons of impiety and critique, our current rhetorics of displacement, define the treason of the intellectuals, the signs of a transgression that has no referent, not even an intramural one. Writing for tenure committees and an overhearing professoriate, we mistake shop talk for scholarship and criticism. The worst of it, for the humanities scholar anyhow, is the abuse we inflict on the language we are missioned to preserve and protect. To begin with such a practical self-criticism would make a real difference in the way we do our work. But humanities scholars face another set of problems and obligations, perhaps even more serious, certainly much less tractable. To expose them clearly, Let me revisit the way we live now from a slightly different perspective. Let us set our inner standing point at the level of the base this time, not the superstructure. Next to critical inquiry's apprehension about the state of critical theory, we should reflect on Stephen Greenblatt's pragmatic worry about the crisis in tenure and publishing. In a special letter, you'll remember, to the members of the Modern Language Association in May of 2002, Greenblatt, who was president then, pointed to the dire academic publishing conditions. He called the problem, quite correctly, a systemic one. A network of relations has bound together for a long time the work of scholarship, academic appointment, and paper-based, in particular university press, publishing. This network has been breaking up or down for many years, and the pace of its unraveling is accelerating. The problem is that most university presses are running at increasingly sharp deficits. This trend will not be reversed, as everyone inside the university publishing network knows. We produce larger and larger amounts of scholarship and pass it on to a delivery system with diminishing capacities to sustain the publication. As an editor of a monograph series, the Virginia Victorian Study Series that I am, I have seen how this pressure alters what a university press is prepared to undertake and publish. The notorious stigma that has grown up recently against single author studies is only one sign of the difficulty. In a grotesque inversion of our most basic goals, near-term economics, not long-term scholarship, has become a serious factor shaping and guiding humanities research for some time, 15 years at least. Just try to find a publisher for primary documentary materials or for any basic research that doesn't come labeled for immediate consumption. Sell this by such and such a date before it spoils. But that is to speak of book publication. We should be aware that a parallel problem, every bit as acute, exists for periodical publication, where a similar dysfunction can be observed. In each of these cases, the university library has become almost the only reliable public purchaser of scholarly books and periodicals, and every year, as we know, library funds for such materials are cut further. The problem has been revisited in the most recent issue of Profession, the journal of opinion about and for the modern language profession. But while the four essays in this Publishing and Tenure Crisis Forum, that's the title, describe the problem very well, their hopes and proposals, I'm sorry to say, fail to address the systemic, the institutional and economic issues. To imagine that funding infusions from ACLS, NEH, and Mellon will stem this tide is to imagine that sandbags will hold back a tsunami. Understand, we're not talking here about the death of the book. As we know, book publishing is alive and well and shows no signs of crisis whatsoever. The problem is that scholarly communication operates in a highly restricted and specialized market. General publishing, by contrast, is open with a diverse and dynamically changing audience to which publishers can appeal and respond. The academic market, by contrast, is largely closed. We are the persons who, for all but alone, produce and consume in this market. The academic market used to be somewhat more broadly distributed, but in the past 25 or 30 years, it has drastically shrunk back on itself. At the same time, the number of producers, of those who by systematic and professional demand are required to produce, has grown enormously. When we then add to the equation the drastic collapse in consumer demand in this market, we are not surprised at the telling numbers. In 1990, a university press would typically print 1,000 to 1,500 copies of an academic book. Today, the number is 200 or less and dropping. Many realize that online scholarly publication is the natural and inevitable response to this crisis of scholarly and educational communication. How to bring about the transition to online publication is the $64,000 question. And it's not the technology that makes the problem so difficult, as the examples of online journal publication, JSTOR, and so forth, Project Muse, show. The Jordan will not be crossed until scholars and educators are prepared not simply to search and access archived materials online and use them in class, which goes on all the time now, increasingly, but to publish and to peer review online, to carry out the major part of our productive educational, communication, and scholarly work in digital form. The institutional resistance to such a major change in scholarly work behaviors is widespread, deep, and entirely understandable. It is not in the short-term immediate interest of scholars or their institutions to make a transition to digital work. Administrators think otherwise, but it's not. They have a very narrow view and a wrong view of the savings that are going to be made by institutions. They're not savings. The upfront costs are enormous, and not even to speak of the human costs. The learning curve is also very steep. Most telling of all, the design of the in-place paper-based system has the sophistication and clear strengths that come from hundreds of years of practical use. With rare exceptions, established scholars have the least practical involvement with information technology. And this, too, is completely understandable. The known scholar can still usually get his or her work published in the usual paper-based ways precisely because they are known, if diminished and diminishing, quantities. The consequences of this situation are apparent. For traditional paper-based work, it is the crisis in the humanities. For humanists who work with information technology, it is another form of that crisis. Digital scholarship, even the best of it, is all more or less atomized, growing like so many topsies, as my mother would say. Worse, these creatures are idiosyncratically designed and so can't easily talk to each other, except in very, as the jargon of this discourse will have it, silos. Your classroom is a silo, or you're doing the Rossetti archive in the little silo, whatever. Everybody's in their little fiefdoms. They also typically get born into poverty, even the best funded ones. Ensuring their maintenance, development, and survival is a daunting challenge, I can tell you. Worst of all, the work regularly passes without much practical institutional notice. The annual MLA bibliography still does not cite online works, no matter how distinguished, say, like the Blake Archive. Accepted professional standards do not control the work in objective ways. Most of it comes into being without oversight or peer review. And that's the kiss of death. What is to be done? Lenin's famous question is very much to the point here. For our scholarship is facing a future that is at once certain and uncertain. It is going to be cast and maintained and disseminated in digital forms. There is no doubt about it. We may not now approve of this, but it is inevitable. We may not know now how to do this, but we will learn because we have no choice. Before getting to some possible choices I want to talk about, I have to tell one more academic story. This tale stretches on a little bit. I better get some water if I'm going to tell it. For as long as I've been an educator, since the mid-1960s, a system of apartheid has been in place in literary and cultural studies. On one hand, we have editing, bibliography, and archival work. On the other, theory and interpretation. I don't have to tell you which of these two classes of work has been regarded as menial, if somehow necessary. And like any system of apartheid, both groups were corrupted by it. As Don McKenzie once remarked, material culture is never more grossly perceived than it is by theoreticians, whose ideas tend to remove them from base contacts with the physical objects that code and comprise material culture. But of course, as he went on to remark, the gross theoretician met his match in the myopic scholar, who tends to get lost in the forest by trancing on the bark of the trees. To this day, at my own university, an institution known for its commitment to serious work in textual and bibliographical studies, most of our advanced graduate students could not talk sensibly, least of all seriously or interestingly, on the problems of editing and textuality and why those problems are fundamental to every kind of critical work in literary and cultural studies. I no longer ask our students in their PhD exams to talk about the editions they read and use, why they choose the ones they do and not another, what difference it would make if they had made different choices. It goes without saying that these are bright and hardworking young people. Nonetheless, the institutional tradition they have inherited largely set those matters at the margin of attention, and never more unfortunately so than in the last quarter of the 20th century. Until that time, the American research program in English studies regularly made history of the language, editing, and bibliographical studies a requirement of PhD work. I know from my own painful experience that these requirements were often taught in killingly mindless ways. Many, therefore, decided that these basic disciplines had little to teach about literature, art, and culture, either of the past or the present. As we all know, in our country, these requirements were universally dropped or eviscerated between about 1965 and 1990. In England and Europe, the situation is completely different because of the history of philology in that part of the world. When I've described our recent educational history in these terms, I have been suspected of fellow traveling with a cadre of moralizers and promoting an instrumentalist approach to education. But remember, William Bennett, Dennis D'Souza, and Lynn Cheney are not enemies of theory or interpretation. They are simply strict constructionists in a field where Cornel West, Catherine Simpson, and Stanley Fish look for broader intellectual opportunities. Seeing the educational history of the past 15 or 20 years in terms of the celebrated struggles between these groups has obscured our view of an educational emergency now grown acute with the proliferation of digital technology. I earlier said I wouldn't be forecasting anything, but here I'm prepared to make a prophecy. In the next 50 years, the entirety of our inherited archive of cultural works will have to be re-edited within a network of digital storage access and dissemination. This system, which is already under development, is transnational and transcultural. Let's say this prophecy is true. Now ask yourself these questions. Who is carrying out this work? Who will do it? Who should do it? These turn to sobering queries when we reflect on the recent history of higher education in the United States. Just when we will be needing young people well trained in the histories of textual transmission and the theory and practice of scholarly method and editing, our universities are seriously unprepared to educate these people. Electronic scholarship and editing necessarily draw their primary models from long-standing philological practices in language study, textual scholarship, and bibliography. As we know, these three core disciplines preserve but a ghostly presence in most PhD programs. Designing and executing editorial and archival projects in digital forms are now taking place, and they will proliferate. Departments of literary study have perhaps the greatest stake in these momentous events, and yet they are, in this country, probably the least involved. The work is mostly being carried on by librarians and systems engineers. Many, perhaps most of these people, are smart, hardworking, and literate. Their digital skills and scholarship are often outstanding. Few of them, however, know anything about theory of text, and they too, like we literary and cultural types, have labored for years in intellectually underfunded conditions. It has been decades since library schools in this country required or even offered courses in the history of the book. Does it shock you to learn that? We aren't shocked at our own instituted ignorance of history of the language or bibliography. Restoring intimate relations between literarians and librarians, a pressing current need, has thus been hampered from institutional developments on both sides. Insofar as departments of literature participate in the work and conversation of digitized librarians, it happens through that small band of angels who continue to pursue serious editorial and bibliographical work, scholarly editors and bibliographers. Okay then, what's the problem? Our traditional departments have managed to keep around a few old-fashioned editorial and bibliographical types. Let's send them out to help with the technical jobs and hope that there, that's our, brains aren't completely fried by beetle-browed and positivist habits. Once upon a time, even they, that's we, were involved with a readerly text, right? Those contacts might perhaps prove barely sufficient were it not for another recent upheaval in the world of higher education. For it happens that between about 1965 in 1985, textual scholars began to rethink some of the most basic ideas and methods of their discipline. I choose those dates because Ernest Honigman published The Stability of Shakespeare's Text in 1965, and in 1985, D.F. McKenzie delivered his famous inaugural Panizzi Lectures, Bibliography and the Sociology of Texts. So disconnected had the general scholarly community grown from its foundational subfield of textual and bibliographical studies, however, that this historic moment passed it by with little notice. The genetic and social editing theories and methods that emerged in those years signaled a major shift in literary and cultural scholarship. Not for 200 years had anything happened, anything like it. Because this change overlapped with the more public emergence of what would be called literary theory, perhaps underlapped really is the better word, it drew scant attention to itself in the more visible orbit of literary and cultural studies. And after that came the dismal culture wars. A forthcoming publication measures the change that overtook textual scholarship at the end of the last century. In 1982, Harold Jenkins published his celebrated edition of Hamlet in the Arden Shakespeare series. This was a lifetime's work, and the book epitomized a traditional so-called eclectic approach whereby Jenkins educed a single text of the play out of a careful study of the three chief documentary witnesses. Soon, a new Arden Shakespeare's Hamlet, edited by Ann Thompson and Neil Taylor, will replace Jenkins' remarkable work. The new Arden Hamlet will not publish a single conflated text. It will present all three witnesses, Folio 1, Q1, Q2, each in their special integrity or lack thereof. In May 2002, The New Yorker reported this event in a substantial piece by Ron Rosenbaum. The article gives a good general introduction to an upheaval in textual studies that has been going on for almost 40 years and that has been at white heat for about 20. Because the world of scholarship moves in a kind of slow motion, such belated awareness would not normally be cause for much notice. But at this particular historical moment, when information storage and transmission and methods of knowledge representation are calling for immediate practical attention, Rosenbaum's piece seems most interesting for what it does not talk about. Force of circumstance today calls us to develop scholarly editions in digital forms. The people who used to do this work in paper forms, people like Jenkins and Thompson, are involved in serious controversies over how it should be done. The theory and practice of traditional textual scholarship is in a lively, not to say a volatile, state of self-reflection. Scholarly editing today cannot be undertaken in any medium without a disciplined engagement with editorial theory and method. So, scholars who think to use information technology resources, as now we must, face a double difficulty. We must learn to use digital tools whose capacities are still being explored in fundamental ways, even by technicians. Nobody really knows how to use them yet. We're all experimenting. We must also approach all the traditional questions of scholarly editing as if a transformed world stood before us and where to choose was fraught with uncertainty. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the context which envelops my main subject, Nines. It's gone away. Networked Infrastructure for 19th Century Electronic Scholarship. I'm going to put it back up on. I was going to do a PowerPoint presentation tonight, but I thought it would be better to give this lecture and just show you this website. There's a lot beyond that top page. Let me say something about it. It's a three-year undertaking, initiated in 2003 by myself and a group of scholars to establish an online environment for publishing peer-reviewed research in 19th century British and American studies. Although the resource will have significant pedagogical and classroom components, it is primarily an institutional mechanism for digitally organized research and scholarship. Let me say that our whole approach at UVA, it's come to be called the Virginia approach, has been through scholarship rather than pedagogy. And it began with the founding of the Institute for Advanced Technology and Humanities. I was on that committee when it was founded, and we sat around, there were about eight of us, and it was founded because IBM gave UVA $1 million in equipment, no money, $1 million in equipment to do with what they want. It was given to the CS department, and the CS had equipment running out of its ears. And they had heard there were a couple of scholars over in the humanities side of things who might have an interest in this. And that was myself and Ed Ayers. And so this group was formed to decide what would we do with this $1 million in equipment. Everybody in the room, with one exception, said the best thing to do is take a democratic approach and spread the equipment around the whole campus and see what would happen. One man there, Alan Batson, this curmudgeon British character, said this was madness. He said, for 35 years, that's what everybody's been doing, and look where we are now. He said, this is not what you should do. What you should do is aim it at high-end research projects on the assumption that all really interesting pedagogical work always comes out of some engaged and intense set of scholarly activities. So aim it at scholarly projects. So the whole approach from UVA from the beginning, this was 92, 93, has been to try to promote digital scholarship. It was a very, very useful way to approach things. On the other hand, it exacerbated and called to great attention the institutional problems. I think since 93, nothing has troubled me more and been a greater source of difficulty than trying to find ways to break across the institutional problems. In 1993, there were four people in our department of almost 50 who had any involvement with digital scholarship. It's now 2006. There are still four people. Two people have left, myself and another person who was involved then, but that's it. There are four. We're still about 50. And UVA is famous as a center for digital scholarship in humanities. Institutional problems are just terrifically hard to deal with. So, this three-year undertaking, and that began in 2003. Although the resource will have, that is Nines, significant pedagogical problem aspects, it will be primarily focused on scholarship. Nines is therefore partly conceived as a professional facilitator and partly as an advocacy group to protect the interests of scholars and educators. It's, as they say, results-oriented. It will liaison with interested publishing venues on behalf of and in the interests of scholars and educators and the work we produce. A coordinated group of editorial boards oversees the work. There are 60 people, three editorial boards, 60 people involved in the editorial boards in vetting this material. A coordinated group, therefore, including various kinds of content, traditional texts and documents, editions, critical works of all kinds, as well as born digital studies that relate to all aspects of 19th century culture. I think I'll stop and not read about this anymore. I'll tell you, we set going in 2003, and we set the beginning of 2006, right now, as the date when we wanted actually to begin to roll out Nines with actual content. And in February, the first release of the first six projects were put up online. The environment is, if you go to Nines, and new Help Test Nines and Colex in our online pilot, you can find out about the tools that we've been developing, a collation tool called Juxta, a collaborative interpretational game space that is very useful, and it's actually mostly useful in pedagogical situations, called Ivanhoe. And then Colex, which is the last of the tools that we're developing, which is a set of devices to allow a scholar to gather different kinds of material from an online and peer-reviewed, that is to say, authenticated set of materials, not just go out anywhere, but Nines materials or something like Nines materials, and put together critical materials of various kinds, editions, critical articles, or whatever, and then publish them in different kinds of forms. That's basically what we're trying to do. What we want to set up, in other words, is a scholarly communication system for publishing peer-reviewed materials in 19th century British and American studies. Next month, we have our second release with about six more projects. Later in the year, there will be about another 6 projects that will come on. And we're looking for, in fact, anybody who is doing digital scholarship and is interested in publishing. What happens in this environment, by the way, is that all the material that's there is integrated. And so that you break across this silo effect. You don't have the Blake archive over here or the Rossetti archive over here, but it's all it's an RDF system where everything has an address that everything else knows about. And so you can use this search engine that we have to crawl all over this material and then use Colex to grab the pieces that you want to put together critical materials that you may be developing. So, let me conclude. I'm a book scholar, about as traditional as you get. My work, including my theoretical work, is historicist and even philological, and my orientation is decidedly humanist. I am not post-humanist, whatever the hell that is. Glory to man in the highest, for man is the master of things. That witty and impish line from Swinburne is very much to my taste. Men and women are indeed called to the mastery of things precisely, of people and of life events. We are and we will always be participants and students, never masters. Drawing that distinction between things and people, between mastery and learning, is what it means to be, as Swinburne was, a humanist. Today, we have to try to master some new things. We have to learn how to make them and how to use them. To pursue that goal commits us to a demanding and therefore humbling adventure in knowledge. We will do this by becoming students again, a role that as educators and humanists, I think we're especially good at. For some of us, this will be a road not taken. Fair enough. But whether we choose to or not, we should all be clear about the slow train that's coming and that won't be sidetracked. The publishing and tenure crisis is one certain sign of what's happening. So is the digital transformation of our research archives, the seat of our cultural memory. Nines is a proposal to engage with these problems in specific and practical ways. It takes a relatively short rather than a long view, because in matters that concern us, we are always humanists, even in the short run. We know that our longest views, our totalizing conceptions, are finally only heuristic and hypothetical. But that humanist understanding is exactly why, as Shelley observed, we mustn't let I dare not wait upon I would. We have to get going now. We can't wait to see if there's more to learn. Of course there's more to learn. That's why we have to get going. How else are we to learn what we don't know? We have to set the stage for our certain failures, if we're to have any chance of measuring our measured successes. We will, as the poet observed, learn by going where we have to go. And one last point is worth reflection. Capitalist entrepreneurs are already actively trying to gain control over as much information as they can. Perhaps never before has knowledge been so clearly perceived as a fungible thing and a commodity to be bought and sold. Humanities scholarship has a calculable market price, and the market will work to buy low and sell high, as the dreadful examples of Elsevier and Kluwer have recently revealed to the science community. And don't imagine that our cultural heritage, what Shelley called our poetry, is safe from commercial exploitation by agents that view our work, what they call the content we produce, as a marketable commodity. Perhaps the chief virtue of a project like Nines is to supply scholars with an institutional mechanism for preserving and protecting what we do. I don't know if we will be successful in our primary objective, leveraging Nines to assemble and publish an initial body of peer-reviewed online scholarship and criticism that can initiate an ongoing venue of such work. I mean, we are doing that, but whether we can sustain it is, I don't know that. It's damned expensive. That's the problem. It's expensive in human costs and then in just in plain old money. Several models are imaginable that would use libraries or traditional scholarly presses as the publishing vehicles or some combination of the two. Whether or not the agents needed to make any of these models work will decide to do so is not clear. The agents, that's to say, ourselves. The matter won't become clear one way or the other until we undertake to design and implement a model. Nines, or anything like it, only can exist in practice, not in theory. Thank you for listening.